When times are really tough, it is the most tempting thing in the world for leaders to hide. But at a time like this, people are often looking to the leader and saying, "Tell us what we need to do." And a leader who can shift his or her style and say, "Okay, folks, here's where we're going. Lead the charge," is often the more effective leader.
Welcome to the Alter Group Podcast on Real Estate. I'm your host, Tom Silva. Today, our guest is Dr. Gail Golden, principal at Gail Golden Consulting, an expert in leadership effectiveness at the senior executive level and enhancing organizational capabilities. Gail was previously professor at the University of Western Ontario. Gail, I'd like to open up by asking you to draw a connection between change management and the current recession.
Classifying what's going on as one large giant change is a reasonable way to think about it. And the first thought that comes to me is that there are two kinds of changes. There are changes that I initiate and changes that happen to me. We are all of us then coping with a change that has happened to us. And that, I think, is in many ways the toughest kind of change to deal with. And there are all kinds of feelings and responses that people have that get in the way of responding effectively to this kind of challenge.
Are there any lessons to be drawn from the way that people are responding to the current recession?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are, of course, a wide range of reactions, and every individual is unique. But one of the models that we use comes from a book called Responses to Change, Helping People Manage Transition, and it's by Carrie Bunker, who is at the Center for Creative Leadership. Classifies people into one of four categories, and it classifies them on two dimensions: how capable they are of dealing with change and how comfortable they are with dealing with change. So you have somebody who is capable of dealing with change but not at all comfortable with it. We call those people entrenched, and they tend to respond to change either by just trying to ignore it and pretend it's not happening, or by engaging in a flurry of activity, sort of frantic kinds of responses that aren't well thought out or really are not going to enable them to deal with the change very effectively. So that's the entrenched group. Another group is the group that is comfortable with change, but not very capable of dealing with it. We call those the posers. So those are people who act like, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I've got it all under control, everything's fine." But in fact, they don't know what they're doing, and they're making decisions and judgments which are not well thought out. And at a time like this, companies have to be really careful that they don't put those people into highly responsible positions, because they'll drive you right off the cliff. And then there's the group that is neither comfortable with change nor very capable of handling it. We call those the overwhelmed. They're just paralyzed and really have difficulty. Sometimes they start to demonstrate psychological symptoms. They really have difficulty in this kind of situation. And then the group that we would all like to be in is the group that is both capable of dealing with change and pretty comfortable with it. We call those group the learners, because they are the ones who will look at the situation, not revert to old patterns of behavior that aren't going to work anymore, but take a look and say, "Okay, what can I learn? How can I be flexible? How can I deal with this? How can I build on what I've done in the past, but do it differently now so that I'm responding to this new reality?"
So what type of leader do we need during a time like this?
I guess what I would say is that I don't know that it's a special kind of leader, but I think there are particular leadership behaviors which leaders need to utilize at a time like this. The greatest leaders are people that have a wide range of different leadership abilities and behaviors available to them. They don't have just one knee-jerk reaction to every situation. And so leaders at a time like this have to look into their toolbox, I think, and pull out particular kinds of leadership behaviors that are going to be most relevant at this time. So, for example, leaders need to be often more directive at a time like this than they might be under other circumstances. We generally encourage leaders to empower their people, to take time to listen and to drive for consensus and to be sure that everybody is aligned. And those are all excellent and important leadership behaviors. But at a time like this, people are often looking to the leader and saying, "Tell us what we need to do." And a leader who can shift his or her style and say, "Okay, folks, here's where we're going," and lead the charge, is often the more effective leader in a time like this.
And should a leader raise or lower their profile during a recessionary period?
When times are really tough, it is the most tempting thing in the world for leaders to hide, to, you know, go up onto the fancy executive suite floor and be behind closed doors and have deep conversations among themselves and stay away from the rest of the people, because people are scared or people are angry or people are demanding, and not every leader is comfortable dealing with those kinds of interactions. But in fact, we know that effective leadership at a time like this is about getting out there and being in contact with your people. Sometimes we call it leadership by walking around, you know, getting out of your office, into the hallways, into people's cubicles, making yourself available.
So I want to get into some more specifics. As an example, do you do the same kind of strategic planning during a recessionary period?
It's not about strategic planning versus non-strategic planning. It's about using a particular tool. What we find is that often the most effective leaders in a time of crisis, they aren't doing traditional strategic planning of sort of the long-term horizons. What they are doing is what we call scenario planning, which is they are laying out different possibilities, the what ifs, if this happens, if this happens, if this happens, with the economy in general, with our company in particular, and then laying out contingency plans for each of those different scenarios, attempting to estimate the probability. Because if something might happen, but it's only a 1% probability, I'm going to spend a lot less energy on that one than on the one I think has a 75% probability. And that kind of systematic thinking about what are the different scenarios and how are we going to get ourselves ready to deal with whatever comes, that's the kind of strategic leadership which is most effective at a time like this.
And do you tend to lean more or less on your senior executive team?
The risk, I think, is that leaders will feel, I'm alone in this. It's up to me to solve this. I have to figure this out. And in spite of what I said a minute ago about the importance of leaders giving direction and showing the way, there's a real risk if a leader isolates him or herself that his or her judgment just won't be as good. So relying on the senior team, sharing the problems with them, getting their perspective, their experience, their analysis, their support is a crucial part that enables that leader then to go forward and say, okay, folks, here's the direction that we're going. So that's another important piece of leadership in a time like this.
So we've talked about strategic planning and then the executive team. Tell me about the employees.
Well, we often think about there being three critical elements. One is the headpiece. People want to understand what's going on. They want to understand, if you want them to make a change, why? What's the rationale for this? So one part of that is engaging people's logic and intellect and giving enough respect that you take the time to explain to people why we're doing what we're doing. The second is the heart piece, that people need to get it at a gut level. They need to believe in it. They need to feel that they are part of this, that they're important, and that, you know, that their feelings are engaged in what's going on. And the third is the hands piece. They need to have the skills and the ability to do what it is you're asking them to do. And so leaders need to be thinking about all three of those aspects as they ask, if you're asking somebody to do something differently, do they understand why? Have you engaged their heart and their passion in it? And have you given them the tools and the skills that they need in order to do what you're asking them to do?
And one of the things that I thought was interesting is you actually build time in for reflection. You think that's important for leaders?
One of the things we know about leadership in general is that it is a whole bunch of skills that are outward facing in terms of how you relate to other people, how you understand and analyze problems, all kinds of outward facing skills. But the greatest leaders also have internal skills that they utilize. Reflection is how I learn from my own experiences, my ability to look at myself and analyze what am I doing that's working, what am I doing that's not working, how does this feel to me. Stress management, you know, the ability to be aware of my own cues so that I know when, you know, I'm getting into my danger zone. I'm overexhausted. I'm absolutely furious, I'm terrified, whatever the case may be. Places where, if I'm a senior leader of a business, I don't want to be operating out of those spaces. So how then do I get myself rebalanced? What do I need to do for myself so that I can operate out of a place of more calm and more solidity? And if leaders are not good at reading their own signals, then they may go off into those spaces and engage in behavior which is either self-destructive or hurtful to their organization or both.
Given all the negative press, what would most surprise people about the leadership in corporations?
I'm fascinated by how often when I'm working with senior leaders, they are people of tremendous humanity and tremendous passion to do the right thing. They work extremely hard and at some considerable personal sacrifice. And again, I don't mean to be sounding naive. They get well paid for what they do, and they love what they do. So this is not as if they're suffering. But they give a great deal of themselves to their work, and they take it very seriously.
Now, this may seem like a strange question during a recession when we've lost 4.5 million jobs, but I'm curious to know why we're still reading about the global war for talent. Is that still a concern for CEOs?
That is certainly no doubt in my mind that the greatest companies and the ones that are positioning themselves for long-term success are very aware of the war for talent and, in fact, are seeing this almost like this is a great time to get talent on sale. You can bring people into your company who will come for lower salaries and than they might have done 12 or 18 months ago, and so it's a really good time to do that.
So what are some of the important tips as far as being able to attract some of the talent that's now available?
And there's not just one answer to that, because different people, different talented people, are attracted for different reasons. For some people, it's about money, and you get people by offering them a better salary than your competitors will offer them. For others, it's about feeling they have a seat at the table, so that even at a fairly junior position, you give them access to sitting in on meetings where decisions get made and feeling as if they've got an ability to influence the direction at the top. That's what some people need in order to come and work for you and continue to work with you. For some people, it's about the values of the company and, you know, I'll only work for a green company or I'll only work for a Christian company or whatever the case may be. I think for a number of people, there also are quality of life issues. So, for example, law firms have found that they used to be able to attract the top talent simply by throwing lots of dollars at young lawyers. And what they are finding now is there are an increasing number of younger lawyers who are saying, you know, I don't want to work 100 hours a week, and I don't care how much money you're going to pay me. I don't want to work 100 hours a week.
Are there certain accommodations that need to be made for the diverse workforce that we now have, both women and more cultures represented?
We know that women tend to manage their careers somewhat differently from how men do. And if you want to attract and retain the best female talent, you often need to permit people to structure their work and their work trajectory differently than if you are just working on a traditional male model.
Gail, the demographics are telling us that there are at least 4, maybe 5 groups, generations, currently working alongside each other. I'm wondering the extent to which those generations are different and need to be managed differently.
I think there are some real differences. For one thing, people entering the workforce now are typically smarter. IQ scores keep going up, and we're not quite sure why, but they do. There's a generational effect. That's a little scary for people my age to recognize that, you know, people coming up behind me, on average, are several IQ points smarter than my generation and I were.
Is that the impact of technology?
I think it, perhaps. I mean, or better nutrition, or who knows. Certainly the impact of technology is enormous, and the comfort with use of technology and with the ability to process multiple visual stimuli, I think there's a fair bit of data that suggests that the younger generation is simply way ahead of any previous generation. Young fighter pilots apparently have better reflex times than even the most highly trained people 10 years their senior. And I just recently heard a presentation about the workforce of the future that said that ability to rapidly process multiple visual data is going to be one of the critical success factors for the worker of the future. You are going to have to be able to do that in order to thrive in the workplace of the future. So that's a real generational difference, I think. But in terms of socioculturally, I think the differences are much exaggerated. I think they have more to do with the age people are than, as I said, the cohort. And I don't think the 20-year-olds of today are all that much different from the 20-year-olds of 30 years ago, other than, as I said, that technological capability that they have.
So for a lot of the younger folk, this is the first real recession they've seen.
In some ways, I think they are at an advantage to be dealing with this early in their work lives. I mean, my peer group and I, who grew up, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, I mean, things were darn good for us. There were jobs, you know, for us. I mean, when I applied to college, I applied to two colleges, one that I wanted to go to and one that recruited me. Nowadays, I mean, the competition to get into top universities, it's a very different landscape. So these young people are going to know about scrambling and about dealing with tough situations. And I think that's a really powerful learning experience for them.
Gail, I want to ask you a little bit about what it's like managing an entrepreneurial culture. That's certainly one that we find in the real estate industry. But when you're managing people who are extremely autonomous and oftentimes at a senior level, what are the challenges of that sort of a culture?
For me, there are two ideas that come to mind right away when I think about managing entrepreneurs. The first one is that you have to give people a lot of autonomy. They will take it, whether you give it to them or not. And you can avoid a lot of frustration and conflict by just setting up the work environment in such a way that entrepreneurs have a lot of autonomy. We see this when a large company buys a small entrepreneurial company, and they either kill it very rapidly by managing it to death, or else they leave it alone and let it remain entrepreneurial within the larger corporate climate, and that's a much more likely route to success, more difficult, but more successful. So in managing entrepreneurs, if you're a micromanager, if you're somebody who wants people to report to you every time they blow their nose, you or they will leave before too long. It's not a good match. I think the dark side to an entrepreneurial culture can be that people, there need to be rules of engagement. People can be really unpleasant. Entrepreneurs are often fairly egotistical, and they may be highly competitive. They may be all about, I'm going to get the prize for myself, and if I have to step on your face along the way, tough luck for you. Get out of my way. And most people don't thrive very well in a culture like that. So some of the really entrepreneurial companies have come up with what they fondly refer to as the no-jerks rule, which doesn't require a lot of explaining. I mean, we know jerks when we see them. We know jerky behavior when we see it. And they simply have a value that says, we don't tolerate that here. And it doesn't matter how much money you make or, you know, how long you've been around. If you act like a jerk, you're out of here. And that creates a different kind of climate, which is more conducive to more people being able to realize their potential. It doesn't mean it's not competitive, but it's not about being a jerk.
And going back to this idea of reflection, so in an entrepreneurial culture, oftentimes you don't have the time to really take stock. And I'm wondering how you think that might affect the quality of leadership.
Somebody who really isn't reflective, I would say in my experience they are limited as leaders in a way that, you know, they could be better leaders if they could do that, simply because their learning is going to be reduced when they don't do that kind of reflection. We know, for example, when you're working with high potential leaders, the people that you're trying to accelerate their development, they need two things. They need to be put into stretch roles where they're being tested and stretched beyond their comfort zone, and they need an opportunity to reflect on what they learn and make sense out of those experiences. And many companies do the first but not the second. They throw their high potentials into, you know, an expatriate assignment or something like that. You know, those kinds of things leaders know how to do. But how do you give those people the opportunity to reflect, whether it's bringing the high potentials together as a group, whether it's providing them with a coach, whether there's a mentor within the organization who does that with them on a regular basis, that reflection is part of what helps them to grow.
Well, Gail, thanks for being with us.
Well, it was really interesting for me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
To listen to more Alter Group podcasts or to read our Alter Now blog, visit www.altergroup.com.